Portland resident Abdi Noor Iftin recounts his remarkable story in a new memoir, Call Me American. Abdi Noor Iftin was 5 years old when the civil war broke out in Somalia. His childhood was a landscape of horrors, brutal violence, starvation, and people disappearing. With creativity, wits, and a lot of luck, Iftin managed to survive and eventually told his story to the world through a series of radio reports, some of them on NPR's This American Life. Iftin learned to speak English by watching American movies in a makeshift theater. He eventually won a diversity lottery visa to the United States and now lives in Portland. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Abdi Noor Iftin's new book comes out tomorrow, and he joins us here today on Maine Calling to discuss his extraordinary life and his reflections on life in America. Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Abdi Noor Iftin's new memoir, Call Me American, comes out tomorrow. In it, Iftin recounts his harrowing childhood in Mogadishu, Somalia, and his remarkable journey to Maine, which included filing dispatches for NPR. Iftin now lives in Portland, where he works as an interpreter. He's a legal resident and on his path to citizenship. Abdi, thanks for joining us here today on Maine Calling.
Thank you for inviting me. It's an honor.
As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about life in Somalia? What is it like to adjust to life here? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Abdi, I finished your book this morning. It's extraordinary. Congratulations. And what a story. I think I'm going to have you start at the beginning. You come from a family of herders. Tell me about the life you were born into. It's a world in which people don't even know their birthdays.
That's very true. I call myself a city boy, and in Somalia, where my parents, specifically, you know, the people of the same age as of my parents, are very proud nomadic people, and they both my dad and my mom kind of ended up in the city because of the famine that hit the country in the 1970s and wiped out all their animals.
Yeah, and that was going to be one of my questions: the drought and the famine, and in the world of your parents, in the world you were born into, your value was how many animals you had, and they had a lot.
Yes, yes, that's how you identify yourself as your wealth. You know, so how many animals, including camels and cows and goats, that someone has, and they never thought that all that wealth would go away at any point. But when they got married, it happened that the famine, which they have never expected would do that to their animals, drove them out from the nomadic life into the city. And, you know, when I talk about the first chapter, Under the Neem Tree, it's my mother can't imagine coming to a city. I'm talking about Mogadishu, which was once called the Pearl. It was so pretty. Mm. It sits under the Indian Ocean. So if you're in the city in the 80s and you're looking up, you know, there were no skyscrapers, there were no tall buildings, but you can see the ocean, you know, peacefully sitting there. And she couldn't just bear, she couldn't stand the noise of the flights that were coming in and out at the time. And the statues that were in the city. And she said, this is too much for me. You know, so it's like I kind of identify myself with her when I'm in Maine. And I'm like, everything seems strange.
Oh, really? Well, you talk about when you first got to Somalia as a little boy seeing the statues and your mom seeing the statues. You talk about your mom first time seeing the statues and thinking they're alive, right? Yeah.
Yes. I mean, and also how the city people treat her. They're like, oh, you smell like a goat pee, you know? And to her, that's not an insult. That's a good thing. And she says, so? That's nice, isn't it? And they're like, no, that's not nice. You need to change your clothes and all that kind of stuff. But we were born in the city.
Right.
From this tribe that are herders that live outside of Mogadishu. And that's their entire life. And, you know, that's how we identified ourselves, Mogadishians. We didn't identify ourselves as tribes.
Right. So your family left, had to leave their village when, in their life, when before you were born, moved to Mogadishu, and then you're 5 years old and the civil war breaks out. And Abdi, from reading your book, it almost seems apocalyptic. Like you can't even imagine the violence. How did you survive? How do you think, when you look back at all the times people you know were the victims of explosions, of suicide bombers, of snipers, of militiamen shooting people for practice, how is it that you are here and alive?
The answer to that question is, I think I was not supposed to die. I was supposed to live to tell my story. There were many times that I thought death was easier than living, because at the age of 5, and then the war starts, and I have an entire chapter in my book called The First Bullets, and it's just chaos. It's complete destruction. It's like, if you look at it, the way I see it at the time, from what I can remember, it's an entire building that collapses, and everything happens very, very fast. And to me, the thing that had, the moment that I realized the war was really a war was when there was, you know, my dad was a basketball player, and we really had a pretty good life. We didn't have refrigerators or anything in the house, but we had food and money. And we had been respected as the basketball family. And then what happens is the guy, I call him the snack bar. He has a bar. He sells the snacks and stuff. And when my dad comes home on Fridays from work, that's where he took us little boys. And I saw this guy being shot, sprayed with bullets, and his face is down on the ground. That's when I realized, wait, is he not waking up from that, you know, from there? And then it's just a chaos, and we lose
our
house.
You're 5 years old when you see your first person murdered in front of you.
That's very true, yes. And then from there, everything falls into the hands of my mother. She's trying to use her nomadic skills to get us to the safety. We run out of the city into this wilderness, you know, a flat land, very dry. And that's where she used to herd her animals. And then we realize that there's nowhere safe. The war comes into every corner of the country. And we have to come back to the city. And I have a chapter in that book called City of Women and Children. It's because they kill men, and they know men are, you know, the ones that can carry again. But then somehow they let go women and children because we can die on our own, or we can die from sniper, you know, shots and whatever, you know, practice shooting that they were doing at the time. So our dad is not coming with us, and we came back to the city. And it's so confusing. We see our house is gone. The tree is standing. And we're both, you know, my brother and I were like holding moms and like, so, you know, looking at each other, now what? And she has no idea what to do. We're in the city.
You know, Abdi, your story, even if it ended there, would be so remarkable. The fact that your family came from this nomadic family, your father became a basketball star, and then the Civil War broke out, and your mother used her skills and her knowledge of herbal medicine to keep you safe. But that's not the end. That's really just the beginning. It's almost hard to believe all of this has happened to one person in one life. Your mother, when you were fleeing Mogadishu, was pregnant.
She was pregnant, and she had faith in what was happening. She realized that this must have been something that God had been so angry with us, because at the time we had money. Our dad used to go to movie theaters, and there were nightclubs, and all of this stuff. And somehow she realized that we have turned our backs against, you know, God.
That's what she believed.
That's what she believed. And she said, I think that's the problem. And, you know, and how that's how my book comes together. It's that's, you know, that's what she believes. Like, we were not supposed to do that. We were to be completely, extremely faithful towards our culture, our religion, and become extremely, you know, Muslim. In, you know, and what she believed was that we need to get rid of all the evil things that were happening in the city. And it was not only her. it was the entire Somali population that at the time believed that this was happening because we didn't have an outside invasion that came into Somalia. It was just within the Somali tribes. And believe it or not, Somalis are the only homogenous communities in East Africa. We speak one language. We have one religion. We have one culture. We all look alike. There's no white, black, or, you know, brown or anything else. It's just one, you know, people. And then the war happens. It's just within us. So that's why she realizes, well, you know what? I think it looks like some of the stories we hear from you know, the history of Islam and how some communities had been turned upside down because of a few evil things that they've been doing. So that's what she believes. That's how we ended up going to the madrasa.
And I wanted to ask you about that, but I want to tell, I just want to let our listeners know, without giving away everything in your book, your mother gives birth to your sister, her daughter, and she dies of starvation.
Mm-hmm. She does.
And your mother handles it.
Well, her name was Sadia, and mom handles it. She was pregnant by the time the first bullet was fired. And throughout all this time, she, you know, the baby was growing in her belly. And somehow the baby came out breathing and fine. But then, sadly, there was no food, no water, and she couldn't give her, she couldn't breastfeed her because there was no milk coming out of her breast at the time. So every time she prayed for her to go away, to die, because death was easier and she could go to heaven. And I remember, you know, when she died, my brother and I were the ones too busy, you know, digging a tiny grave for our sister. And we actually thought, you know, fine, this makes it much easier. She's gone, and now she's out there somewhere, you know, in heaven and enjoying her, you know, new
and
life.
And this is what you're going through at something like 8 years old.
That's very true, yes.
Wow.
And
so, Abdi, at this point, you started about talking about the madrasa, which I think a lot of people here have heard of madrasas. We know that they are schools, mm-hmm. religious schools, but I didn't really know what it involved. Describe your madrasa.
Well, madrasas in my time, and I believe up until now, madrasa is where you know, there are no seats or benches or chairs or anything. It's just, you know, you can sit on the ground and pieces of boards. That's how we wrote our lessons. So, and there's one teacher, and he uses sticks that are bundled together. And the reason for that is in our culture, we believe that beating or punishing can get you learn something. So at this point, you know, at the madrasa where we were going, and my madrasa teacher was Malim Basbaz, you know, and he used hot papers on wounds so that you really feel the pain, or otherwise you may not be able to memorize 114 chapters of the book. It's all memorization.
And the book is the Quran. The point of the madrasa is to be able to memorize the Quran.
Yes, all of it.
And every time you make a mistake, you're beaten with sticks.
That's very true.
And you're a little boy.
And I was a very little boy. Yep.
And your mother supports this.
She does.
And you understand why she supports it.
I do understand why she supports it. Because to her, this is the way that things happen. This is how you can be. I mean, she's looking at the madrasa teacher himself. Like, how did he really learn this? He probably told her, you know, his own story. He said, like, I was beaten. And now I'm very thankful. And that's how it happens. And then you look at the communities, like, who's the best respected sheikh, you know, or the one who's leading the prayers, or, you know, or the community or stuff like that. Those were the role models. So to be that role model, you must be punished. No good deed goes unpunished. So that's.
And this is all going on. You and your brother are dodging bullets. You're walking in a war zone to go to the madrasa, to learn the Quran, to be beaten by a sheikh, and to come home and to help your mother when you're 8 and your brother's 9 years old. Tell me about the movie house, the place that ended up becoming your refuge.
It became a refuge. It also became my way out. You know, that's how I will eventually be able to escape. So everything is wiped out from Mogadishu. No more movies, you know, and madrasas are just springing up every corner of the city and the communities. You know, a view is shifted from we did the wrong thing and the way we can do right is this way. So let's let, you know, the madrasa teachers and sheikhs run this country. And at the time, they didn't have power yet. The warlords were there, the militias were there, and no Islamic leader or anything had any weapons at the time. So what happens is Falis, who's the woman who runs this movie theater, used to work at a movie theater when there were, you know, peace. And she comes back to the city, and somehow her relatives are able to save her house from being, you know, destroyed or looted. And she comes back and she says, thank you, guys. And she brings out the little TV screen that she has in the house and puts it on a table in her shack. And she says, like, you know, and she posts all this wonderful, big, strong Arnold Schwarzenegger, Sylvester Stallone, this Hollywood actress up there. And I remember standing right there, bare feet, just watching these guys, you know.
So I'm trying to picture this in my mind's eye, Abdi. You're in a mud shack. Mm-hmm. With posters of American movie stars, action heroes on the walls, and a small television with a VCR on a table. People are gathering around to watch the movies.
That's true.
And you come to every single one.
I do come to every single one, even though you have to pay to come there. But I somehow let her know that I'm going to clean this place from spiders, spider webs, and I will clean this place. I will do that job, the physical job, if you can let me sit there and watch. You know, and this is... she was so surprised. You know, it's like, wow, you're doing that job for me. That's great. You know, so, and then we become friends and she considers me as, you know, one of those closest people that she has in the area and a movie buff. You know, I'm right there every day.
And while others are watching the movies with the volume turned down, you're saying, turn up the volume. Mm-hmm. I want to learn English. And it's quite an English you learned. And you can't even repeat a lot of what you learned on the radio. But you learned a very, you learned slang as your first English.
Yes. We were looking for some sort of entertainment. So most of the people who come there are interested in the action part of it. Like when people are getting killed, when the, you know, bullets are sprayed. It's just like, It kind of has a feeling of what's happening in the city. But to me, I somehow, you know, become interested in the conversation of what's happening in the movie. Like, what are they talking about? You know, what kind of language is this? And I'm interested. And it seems like whenever a good conversation happens and then an action happens, you know, it's like it's kind of related. So I asked her, I said, Felice, can you please turn up, you know, the volume? And she says, you know, she swears. And she says, why the heck would you want to watch it? You know, to listen to what they're saying. we're sitting on the ground and, you know, and it's a crowd of people. And I start shouting whenever he says he's going to kill. Oh, he says he's going to jump. Oh, he says he's going to do this, you know. And I become a translator in the movie.
Okay, so I have to take a break. We're talking with Abdi Noor Iftin. He's a Somali immigrant living in Portland, Maine. His new memoir comes out tomorrow. It is called Call Me American. We'll be right back.
You make Maine calling possible, as do Taggart Construction in Freeport, working to create healthy homes that respect the environment since 1994. TagCon.com. And Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communication systems. NorrisInc.com.
On the next Fresh Air, John Prine talks about his life and music. His new album, The Tree of Forgiveness, is his first in 13 years. Prine's first album came out in 1971 when he was just 24 and working as a mailman. Several of those songs became classics, including Angel from Montgomery, Sam Stone, and Paradise. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock, right here on the stations of Maine Public Radio. And a special thanks to Helen from Auburn for her donation of a 2000 Volvo V70. Donations to the Maine Public Car Donation Program make a big difference for your public radio station, and in most cases result in a tax deduction for you. Towing is free, and the great feeling you get from supporting the programming that you enjoy and count on is priceless. If you're thinking of what to do with your car, please consider Maine Public. It's easy. Just visit mainepublic.org, click on Support, and then the Maine Public Vehicle Donation Program. Thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Call Me American, a memoir by my guest, Abdi Noor Iftin. Abdi grew up in Somalia and fled to America as a young man. We invite you to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Abdi, when you were in Mogadishu, your nickname became Abdi American, and that was a good thing and a bad thing, right? Because you had a reputation for being able to teach people English.
That's true. And my book's title is Call Me American, and that's where it starts from. So I was so excited for my friends to call me that name. My mother almost disowned me because of that. But I said, you guys call me American, okay? And the main, and why I said that was, thought that it would be a good name specifically when the United States Marines came to Mogadishu, and then the movies, and I realized the two things are together, but different. You know, if you look at it, they're all Americans, but the movies is not real, but the fight is real, and they leave because of the fight with the militias and all of that. And I tell my friend, I keep going to the movies again, this time completely differently, because I want to learn English, because I wasn't able to communicate with the Marines on the ground, even though we came so face-to-face, and we looked in the eyes, and I could only point to my belly and show them that I'm hungry, you know, I needed to give them something, and they were just providing all this tasty meal at the time. I realized their name was, you know, Americans. In Somali, we call them Americans. And I called my friends and said, please call me American.
But this nickname could have gotten you killed.
That's later when I am no longer a teenager. I'm in my 20s. And Al-Shabaab, which is a radical Islamist group, comes and runs over the entire, you know, southern Somalia, and specifically Mogadishu. They are just every corner of the city. And my madrasa classmates, you know, the same guys who went to the madrasa with me, were the police officers, you know. And so I was known to my behavior of liking, you know, the Western culture, specifically America, and my nickname and all of that. And I received a phone call at one point, you know, and someone picks up, you know, calls me, and I pick up, and it says no number. And he says, are you the one that they call, you know, American? And they say, you have to stop or drop that wicked nickname, or, you know, something's going to happen. So that's what they were doing to kill people. They just warned first. And then the second thing is they kill you. They have done that to so many people at the time in the city. So it was something that was everywhere, and once you get a phone call like that, you just expect to die. So I was in that position where, like, I almost regretted of calling myself that nickname, and I you know, ran around and told everyone, please stop calling me that nickname, and I want to have my American, you know, dream and everything else inside me. It's no longer something I need to express and say, because I was out there on the streets trying to, I don't know why I did this, but when President Bush invaded Iraq and Afghanistan, I was out there, you know, running around and saying he's right. I was not a politician. I had no idea what was going on, and I didn't realize how big this could be. But to me, it was just exercising and practicing my English and say, like, you know, I just wanted to sound like he was sounding and doing that. And I was not scared and afraid. But, around when the Al-Shabaab, the terrorists arrived, I regretted. I said, oh my God, you know, that can get you killed. Why did you even say that? Why were you doing this type of thing? It really got me scared. But it did not break my spirit. I was still up there and trying to do something else. That's how I ended up eventually to be able to become a reporter for a radio station in North Carolina.
I was going to ask you the story. How did you come to file stories for NPR? It started when you saw a reporter from the Chicago Tribune in a window.
That's true. His name was Paul Solbeck. And this is when America sponsored Ethiopian troops to invade Somalia, thousands of them, so that they could fight the radical Islamists in Somalia. And they were, I'm talking about Islamists, they were chanting and they were all over the streets with huge loudspeakers saying, like, we're going to go all the way up to America. That's what we are going to do. Ethiopia is just nothing. And then the Ethiopian troops cross the border into Somalia, and they're on their way to Mogadishu, and they come, and the war happens. Paul Solbeck arrives. He's like one of a very rare journalists that land in Mogadishu at the time with his photographer, and I see them taking pictures, you know, because I see his wife with a blonde hair, and I'm like right there standing, and I wave, and I say, hi, what's up, you know? And you know, the bodyguards, Somali guys with the AK-47 and stuff like that, they all point their guns at me. And he comes down and says, no, don't do that. So he clears the way and lets me in and hands me a Pepsi Cola, the most delicious thing I've ever drank. And I said, wow, this is great. Do you have another one? And he gives me three of them. And we keep talking all the time. And he says, wow, you have a story, man. And I need to put this story, you know, into, he was working for the Chicago Tribune at the time. So that's how it all started. And he puts me in touch with Corey Brinsell, the producer of the radio station in North Carolina called The Story. And then I receive a phone call one day, one afternoon. And that was, I think that call had, is the one that had changed everything.
Because you started telling your story for an audience in America.
I did. It was a very difficult decision at the moment because under the Islamists, you cannot be a reporter. And specifically, you can't be a reporter who speaks English. And you cannot tell the stories of what they're doing. And that's I was doing the three things. My reports were in English, and I talked about how hard life had been under the Islamists. How I can no longer listen to music, how I can no longer walk with my girlfriend, how I can no longer speak English, how they, you know, decide the way I dress and everything else. And I feel like life sucks, you know, it's horrible. And I tell it. I'm not scared of it. I tell it. And that's how, you know, when the story goes out and so many Americans listen to the story, and then it's amazing. It just everything starts to fall into place.
You file reports for the story, and I should say you have dug a hole in your bedroom floor as a place to hide from the shelling, and this is also where you go to record your reports.
Mm-hmm.
You're crouching in a hole in the dirt of your bedroom floor, doing something that could get you killed.
Very true. Yes.
You file first for the story. This American Life picks up your story. You're on the Moth Radio Hour. And suddenly you have something that you refer to as Team Abdi. Tell me about Team Abdi.
Well, so Team Abdi begins from Paul Solbeck, the journalist I met in Somalia. Even though he's a reporter, he has really been very involved in my life. He read all the emails that I sent him. He got back to me, and every time he said, you know, keep your head low because the war was happening. And he was based in Johannesburg, South Africa at the time. And he was looking very closely at what's happening in Somalia. And he said, Abdi, these stories are very important because, you know, we're not hearing the real stories on the ground of Somalia because all the reporters left. And we have become the forgotten nation. The United States withdrew in 1994. And then they're not looking back, and the world is not even, you know, any more interested because everything became normal. Somalis are in the civil war, and, you know, everything's collapsed and all that. They don't care, except, you know, when I hear all these jets and warplanes flying over Mogadishu. So my stories have become very important to Paul. He was just listening and reading what was going on in Mogadishu at the time, and I would tell him, you know, my friend had just joined Al-Shabaab, and he's gone. He's so happy to die in the, you know, in the war. And, you know, they were just programming everything. There was so many training camps that they have been recruiting people. And what I was telling Paul was, I'm at an age, I'm no longer a teenager. I'm at an age where they really love people of my age because they needed people to recruit. And they have been, you know, when we went to the mosque, they rounded up everyone and, you know, asked our names. And they said, come tomorrow morning, first time, and we're going to, you know, train you on how to fight and how to do that, that kind of stuff. And I skipped. I never showed up. And that could have killed me too. But I was doing that because I was not interested in this. So life had been really, really difficult. But Paul somehow, you know, when the radio thing happened and Corey Purcell and then Dick Gordon, the radio host, and Sharon McDonald, I want to mention her as well, who lives in Yarmouth, Maine, hears my story and sends an email to the radio people, says, oh my gosh, we need to save this young man. And Sharon talks to everyone else in her family and her friends and someone who was her student, because she's a doctor, someone who was her student in Nairobi. And 6-7 people come together, and that become Team Abdi. And everyone is an American citizen.
So Sharon, here's your story. Here's your story in NPR, maybe on Maine Public Radio, and sends an email to the producer.
Mm-hmm.
Who forwards it to you, and you begin an email friendship with this woman from Yarmouth, Maine.
We do.
Who in the end, and again, there's a journey between this point and this point, will be your sponsor and bring you to America.
In her emails, she says that she has a son a bit younger than I am, and he was going to college at the time in Vermont. And she talks about him. She talks about the winter, sends me a picture and video of snow and her dog and her family and the horse, the barn, and all of these beautiful things that you can imagine. And she says, we wish we could save you, but is there a way that we can do that? And I say, you know, first thing is, to me, I need to save my life, which is I need to live here, at least, and go somewhere. And funny thing is, I don't know where I'm going, because Kenya had closed its borders, the same, you know, because she, you know, there's a feeling that anyone coming from Somalia is a terrorist. So they closed their borders. You cannot fly in. You cannot cross the border. And I get on a flight and I go to Uganda and smuggle myself across the border from Uganda, not from the Somali side. And I end up in Nairobi and join my brother, who has been there 9 years as a refugee before me. And he says, welcome to the refugee life. And that's the first time I've been a refugee in my entire life, because you cannot be a refugee in your own country. So I've been locally displaced all this time. And now another chapter in my life is welcome to the refugee life. And he takes me to KFC, and we have a chicken and, you know, all these tasty things. I said, like, wow, they eat this in America. That's great, you know. And then my brother and I had been supported by Sharon and her family, and they say, let's try to get you to the U.S. And we apply for Southern Maine Community College. We got accepted. But then the U.S. Embassy is not giving us a visa, because they say, well, a student visa is a non-immigrant visa, which means if you go to SMCC and finish your studies, you need to come back. But where are you guys coming back? Because you do not have a valid ID in Kenya. A refugee ID is not actually a valid ID in Kenya. You can get kicked out anytime.
So the U.S. Embassy suspects that you want to come to Maine, not just to be a student, but to live. And they're right.
And they're right. I 100% agree. And they're right.
So how is it that you're here? And how can you sort of quantify, Abdi, how lucky you are? Is there a way to even explain what the odds are?
So from here, for those listeners that had heard my story on This American Life, they know exactly what happened after. And for those who did not, I just want to explain. So we got denied to go to school in the United States, and they're right, because it's not an immigrant, and we're refugees, we're not supposed to do that. And refugee process takes forever, and it's like a lottery itself. You can never, you know, you might not. So at this point, my brother seemed like he was not making it to the U.S., because 9 years is a long time for consideration, and it seems like, you know, the U.S. wasn't really considering his case or might not be able to bring him in. And he says, let's try Abdi, you know, let's try you. And I go and you know, to the UNHCR and say, like, you know, can you do the resettlement process with the U.S.? And they say, like, that takes quite a long time. So the next appointment is 2 years from now. So it's all a headache. So Team Abdi get together and they say, well, it seems like it's hard to come to the U.S. They tried everything and nothing had worked because it's so you cannot sponsor two Somalis or a Somali guy in his 20s from Somalia, because at the time Somalia is still considered as one of the safe haven for terrorists. So it's hard to trust. And Team Abdi decides, let's send you to college in Kenya and we will pay for the fees. And we said, great. So my brother and I had been hawking on the streets, selling socks, hats, you know, whatever we could to earn some money for living and also some money to bribe the police, because they come to us every time in the neighborhood where we live, take some money from us. If you can't pay, they decide to send you back to Dadaab, which is really very difficult place to live. So at this point, we go to college. My brother gets accepted into Methodist University, and I get accepted to African Nazarene University, and we're just having this really, you know, good life of like hawking and getting some money and going to school and all of that. And the same terrorist group that I fled in Somalia attack Nairobi, the same city where we were living. And the Kenyans say, enough's enough. We're going to send all of you guys back to Somalia. Or if you don't want to go back to Somalia, we're going to send you to prison. And
so you're lumped into al-Shabaab because you are from Somalia, from Mogadishu. In the eyes of the Kenyan government, you are suddenly someone who needs to be pursued. We need to take another break, Abdi. I'll pick up after there. We're talking with Abdi Noor Iftin. His new memoir comes out tomorrow.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do New England Cancer Specialists, committed to leading the way to better outcomes for 50 years. More at newenglandcancerspecialists.org. And Maine Community Foundation, celebrating 35 years of investing in Maine communities. Learn more at mainecf.org.
Coming up on the next Commonwealth Club program, is American-style liberty under threat? Around the world, authoritarianism, nationalism, and tribalism are gaining ground. And Jonah Goldberg believes liberty is even under threat here in the United States, where he worries that identity politics has come to dominate our political discourse. Hear what this conservative commentator has to say about the state of traditional Western values on the next Commonwealth Club radio program.
That's coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock.
When Stephanie's son was diagnosed with autism, she felt scared and desperate. Then she found a kind of alternative therapy called Brain Balance. It was pricey.
But what are you going to do? Maybe work a few more years, take a little bit out of your retirement so that he's able to have a better life going forward?
An investigation into the science behind the popular program this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered this afternoon from 4 to 6:30 right here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Abdi Noor Iftin is with me, the author of Call Me American, a memoir about his life in Somalia and here in Maine. So before the break, Abdi, we were talking about you've made it to Nairobi. You're a college student and al-Shabaab moves in, and suddenly anybody who is Somali, especially a young man of Somali descent, is just lumped into the same category and is either going to go back to Somalia or is going to be arrested. And it was really a fluke that you found out about the diversity lottery at that point, isn't it?
Yes. You know, when you're in Kenya, the Kenyans have this was really amazing to me, because even the Kenyan citizens, the guy who was running this place where people have been applying the lottery, I was having a tea with my friends right across where that internet place was, and there was a note that he put on the wall that not many people knew about, but some people knew about. So people were going in and applying for their things, and he texted
pictures. So a note that said, apply for the U.S. diversity lottery here.
Yeah, it was October. So that's when it opens. It opens in October and then ends at the end of October. So the note said, you know, try your luck and apply for the U.S. green card diversity lottery. And so I told my friends, hey, why don't we try this? And they all, you know, give me this look like, nope, it's not going to work. You know, I'm so sure this is just a funny dream. And I said, you know what? I'm going to try it. So I try it. I apply. And it's easy to do it. It doesn't take 5 minutes, just a picture and a few information and all that. But then it takes 7 months for the results to come out. And the chances of being selected, you're not going to win the lottery yet, but you get selected. And
you get selected to be considered.
To be considered. And you have to go through so many different things before your visa is...
And what are your chances of being selected to be considered?
So unfortunately, I had so many problems at the time.
What are the chances? I mean, how many people do you know who are also selected?
I know zero people who were also selected.
How many people have you ever heard of who were also selected?
11 million people apply every year, and they only select 125,000, between 125,000 and 130,000 people.
So the it's really winning the lottery.
Exactly, yes.
And then then you had to prove a lot of things. You had to prove that you did not have a record, which meant going to the police department as a Somali man.
I know. Yes. And being a Somali itself was a problem. First of all, I don't have a passport of my own. I don't have a birth certificate. I have nothing. All I come with is my physical appearance and the language that I speak. And but when the embassy asks me, so what's your nationality? I have to say a Somali. And being a Somali, the U.S. Embassy requires two things. You must have graduated from high school, or you must have worked with a reputable agency like, you know, USAID or something like that. And then they might consider your visa. So when I won that, when I got selected, I mean, I was so happy, and my friends were lifting me up and down and everything else. And my brother and I got together and we did Googling, and we realized that this was only the beginning. And the Al-Shabaab thing happened, and everything is in chaos, and Somalis are being deported. And this apartment where we live, everybody else got picked up. And some have voluntarily given themselves up to the police, and they said, we're ready to go. So they've been sent back to Somalia. And then we end up being the only two Somalis in that entire apartment, with the whole block, you know, surrounded by cops and police and cars and stuff like that. And my brother says, Abdi, give up. It's not going to work. And I say, no, I think this is the last chance that I have to get my American dream become real.
So if somebody wants to hear how you got here, I'm going to tell them they have to read the book because we're almost out of time. And I want to ask you a couple questions, Abdi, about your experience here in America. But before that, also about your brother, Hassan. He's very important to you, a very important part of your memoir. Mm-hmm. Shared your dream of coming to America. Where is Hassan now?
Hassan is in Nairobi. And he has a wife and he got twins. He was denied to come to the U.S. He was given a final denial letter. But the good news is that Team Abdi now named themselves Team Hassan, and I am part of the team now, not as a refugee, but as a proud American resident. And I've been supporting my brother ever since, and we tried everything. And now we tried a Canadian process, and he was accepted to come to Canada. And that had happened after I finished the book. So people might not be able to read that in the book, but I just want to share this great news that he's going to be resettled into Toronto pretty soon when his wife gives birth, because she is pregnant right now.
And your mother and your sister who survived, are they both still alive? And how are they doing?
They they are both in Mogadishu, and it things are the same. Nothing had changed in Somalia. The war is happening. The Islamists are over there, and there's a government that's fighting the Islamists, and it's just, you know, a tit for tat kind of war that's happening at this moment. So they are living in the middle of this situation. At least now they have a roof over their head and they can cook, because I send money back home every time. But I really have a, like when they call me and I see my mother's number, my sister's number calling from Somalia, I get scared. I, you know, they can say anything. Anything can happen in Mogadishu anytime. And whenever they call me, they have some news to share. And they say, like, there was a bomb, you know, behind our house and none of us was hurt, but the neighbor just got, you know, killed and all that kind of stuff. And I tell them, don't call me until it's emergency. I will call you, because that gives me some peace, because I might be driving, you know, and I don't want to see that to happen.
Your life right now, you're a student at the University of Southern Maine. What do you hope to major in?
Political science.
Political science. And why are you studying political science, Abdi? What is your long-term dream?
I've been struggling and trying to do social studies, political, you know, all of these things. And I'm not here so long time. It's 3 years and 9-10 months right now. So it's going to be 4 years very soon. And I think I'm trying to study political science to try to be able to have an understanding beyond what I have right now on how the world works and how I might be able to be fully involved and become a very important person in how to save you know, Earth and you know, become an important part of the process of making peace much better than we have right now.
You have found your experience here in Maine is different than many of the other Somali Americans, many of the other new Mainers. How so?
Well, first of all, Maine has both kind of shocked me and also surprised me. I landed one evening when Michael Brown, a young black man, was shot and killed in Missouri, and all these violent, you know, demonstrations were happening all over the television. And I saw that, and I, you know, I came to Yarmouth, which is a funny place, where, you know, kind of a little bit less diverse compared to Portland. And, you know, my adopted family that I lived with started introducing me to the neighbors. And, you know, we had a sign in front of our house saying, young man from Africa, no drugs, but I need to work. And, you know, and wherever we walked, we told people, please don't call 911. So that had, you know, kind of really shocked me. It's like, it, you know, this is not the America that I really expected. I thought that you could be going to somewhere where, you know, you can feel welcome and you don't have, you know, to worry about people calling 911 on you, because I'm brand new to town and I'm this person of color. And this was happening in Missouri, you know, cops killing people and stuff like that. But also, I decided to come to Portland and play some soccer at Back Cove. And I was so surprised at the diversity in Maine, really surprised, because at least, you know, 10 languages were being spoken. And I, for the first time ever, I saw so many Africans that I've never imagined that I could see. Burundi, Rwanda, Congo, Nigeria, you know, Senegal, and all this wonderful diversity in the U.S. And I said, wow, America is more, you know, multicultural than I had expected. And it's I want to say that it's so amazing for me to be in Maine and be able to celebrate Thanksgiving, July 4th, you know, and eat steak, hamburgers, and, you know, apple pies. And also, it was Eid 2 days ago, and celebrate my own traditional, you know, things that we do back home. I could never be able to do this in Kenya. I could never be able to do this in Somalia. I'm really so excited to be here.
Abdi, his book comes out tomorrow, Call Me American. It's an incredible memoir. He's speaking Thursday at the Gray Public Library. He's speaking Wednesday, June 27th at the Portland Public Library and print a bookstore. All those links will be on our website. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Maine Calling's produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Thank you, Abdi, for being here on Maine Calling.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.